Welcome back to The Bonfire, where we talk about the UFC and mixed martial arts. I am your host, longtime MMA journalist and MMA junkie senior reporter, Mike Bond, and we have a great show in store for you guys today. On the back end of UFC 310, Luke Thomas of Morning Combat, longtime MMA media member, a longtime friend of mine, joins the show for the first time. We are going to rank the 14 pay-per-views that happened in 2024 from UFC 297 all the way through UFC 310, which were the best in hindsight. We gave an open criteria and Luke and I kind of compared lists here. It was a lot of fun, a few differences in approach how we did this, but I thought we both came out with some good discussion and an interesting ranking on both of our sides. We are also going to talk a little bit about Ilya Topuria's claim he might vacate the UFC featherweight title to move up to lightweight, called out Charles Oliveira on an interview on Spanish radio this week. Very interesting potential fallout from there. And then we will talk a little bit about the UFC's already announced 2025 schedule. A lot of fun with Luke. Please make sure to like the video, subscribe, follow, whatever you can do on whatever platform you are consuming this, whether it is audio or video. We'll take a quick break and be right back with Luke. And we are back with a first-time guest here on The Bonfire, Mr. Luke Thomas, who I remember the days of you having me on your YouTube channel, Luke, when you were just getting things started, and I appreciate you coming here, returning the favor for me here on the pod.
Happy to be on. Thank you, my friend. I appreciate the invite.
Yeah, man. How you been? Everything good?
Yeah, mostly. I'm just, you know, old and tired, and that's a hard thing to deal with, but other than that, I'm all right.
Yeah, we're coming to the end here, right? The break in the schedule, the longest break we get is very much in sight. Just one UFC event left, UFC Tampa this weekend. How much are you looking forward to a little bit of downtime here?
Definitely looking forward to some of it, although it's not too much. I mean, you have Fury Usyk next week, not the end of this one, but the following. Mm-hmm. And then what's the first UFC event? Is it the 18th?
11th is the first 11th. Fight night. That's Mackenzie Dern and Amanda Ribas.
Yeah. Which is the rematch. So right after that, it kind of kicks into high gear, because then on the boxing side again, you got Benavidez and Morel. So not too much of a downtime, but I'll take what I can get.
Yeah, definitely. All the pay-per-views at least are in the books now, right? We had 14 this year, closed out with UFC 310. The reason I invited you on was I kind of want to rank the pay-per-view main cards we got throughout the year and how they turned out compared to maybe expectations. But first, I just wanted to talk to you about, I guess I wouldn't call it breaking news, but something that came in Monday night as I was kind of preparing for the show here with Ilya Topuria, right? He goes on, I believe it was Spanish radio out there, and kind of shares that he is maybe done at featherweight and no longer interested in defending that title, wants to move up to lightweight and proposed a fight with Charles Oliveira in maybe April, May, somewhere in that range. Your thoughts? I know Ilya Topuria can do a good job of trolling us a little bit, keeping his name in the headlines. He does that well, but are you taking this seriously?
Sort of. I mean, he has been somewhat consistent about saying he's going to be done earlier than normal. He also said he'd be done by age 30. Mm-hmm. You know, I believe that when I see it, but he certainly has not strayed from that message. I also believe what he is saying, in to the extent that, you know, does he really want to fight again at featherweight and cut that weight as much as he would like to go to 155? Probably not, right? So I think there's something to be said. Also, in a vacuum, not asking for a title fight right away at 155 and assuming this would happen, which, by the way, I don't think it will. I'll get to it in just a second. But assuming that you know, he takes a number one contender fight, essentially, gives up the 45 belt, I like a Topuria and Oliveira fight, like in a vacuum. Like, it sounds like a great fight. I would be totally in favor of it. But like, as a general rule, I don't like this at all, to be perfectly honest with you. I actually kind of hate it. You know, ultimately he can decide what he wants to do with his own career, but champions not defending their titles because they have sexier opponents either below or above them, in different weight classes is a thing I understand, but I'm not as sympathetic to. I mean, we'll probably talk about UFC 310 in just a second. And like, you look at that, and of all the champions that they have on the roster right now, it might be Pantoja who has the best case for moving up in weight, because he has Kaikara France left. They got rid of Muhammad Mokaev. That's it. He's beaten everybody else. Okay, there may not be like the business case for him to go up, but like, there clearly is a choice to be made here about what the hell they're going to even do at this point. That's a strong argument. Topuria, okay, don't get me wrong, knocking out Volk and Max is like one of the most insane back-to-back achievements you'll ever see in MMA. But there's work to be done. Diego Lopez is out there. Volk wants a rematch. Here comes Movsar. Like, these are good, exciting bouts, and maintenance of a division is important. So the thing I'll come down and say, just to wrap up, fighters say lots of things, Mike, and you know this. They say lots of things. But in the end, the UFC has so much control over the process that we have to kind of wait and see what they want to do before we can even really declare, like, how serious we even need to, you know, take these kinds of comments.
Yeah, and I obviously didn't watch the whole interview. I don't speak Spanish, but I know my colleague at MMA Junkie, Danny Segura, your friend as well, did some translating, and I think one of the things he put out was that I guess he has approached the UFC with this idea, and it was being like early negotiated or something. But yeah, I don't know what this means. I mean, like you said, it's a good fight, but if it means him giving up the title and pushing Volkanovski to the side, that doesn't really make sense to me. And I don't know if he either has to fully commit and wash his hands of the division, or if maybe they'd allow him to do a one-off. But if they're planning this event in Spain in the first quarter of next year, like, feel like it's got to be a Topuria title defense.
And also, if I'm Topuria and I'm headlining in Spain for the first time, I'm not saying I want an easy opponent, but I wouldn't want to be like, oh, now I'm going to go up and wait right in front of the time that I go home to Spain. You would want something a little more manageable. Again, you know as well as I do, Diego Lopez, not an easy fight. Movsar, not an easy fight, but it's still within the constrained universe of appropriate challenge. Like, going up to fight Charles is like really speculative, you know, and to say nothing of Islam or whatever. So again, I'll wait to see what the UFC has to say about this. I understand why he wants to kind of hurry things along and then cash out early. I do get it, but this seems like way early.
Yeah, and if you're the UFC, you probably don't make any decisions before UFC 311 on January 18th, right? Because if Islam wins, maybe like you could make the same case. He's kind of cleared out the division for the most part. There's maybe not someone like super obvious that's fresh for him. Of course, Charles probably deserves his own title shot, but maybe in that case, like Ilya going up is interesting. But if Armin wins, I could totally see them trying to do a trilogy fight between him and Islam, maybe in Abu Dhabi in the back half of the year.
Yeah, no question about it. And then on the other side at 170, you know, we'll see what happens with Bilal. But as long as he's holding on to that, you know, Islam is not going to move up to fight him. Do you really want Islam to go and fight a third time, basically a featherweight guy? Now, not Scrubs, two times Volk and then one times Ilya. Okay, I mean, none of these fights are like bad per se, and some of them are actually quite good. But just given the way in which the sport operates and needs to operate for its own health and sort of continued maintenance, these are aberrations you have to find time for, not just throw in quickly because you've just decided like, well, I'm kind of bored with it all now. It's like, I'm not really a fan of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess the one thing to maybe give Ilya some credit, I know Islam during the press conference and when he did some media last week for that UFC 311 presser, he kind of said, I don't want to fight another featherweight coming up. If Ilya did beat Charles Oliveira, you couldn't really make that argument anymore. He would be, I guess, a proven lightweight then who had beaten the number one contender.
Well, this is what I mean. Like, if they end up going this route and he actually does beat Charles, well, now you're in a kind of a different place. Like, he actually earned a spot at it where you're like, well, what are we going to do? I'm just saying, all things being equal, having champions who are willing to maintain their divisions not only is good for their, you know, standing, pound for pound rankings, and then ultimately in the course of history where they get recorded, but it's good for the sport. It is good for the sport to have contenders rotating through and with a champion that people know and with a champion that can be built around and just abandoning divisions. Like, we're so used to it now that we don't really understand, but like, that used to be scandalous. Mm-hmm. It used to be scandalous to just leave a belt and then, you know, the division has to pick up the pieces and rebuild itself. It's not good for it. I would prefer to see, at a bare minimum, a different set of circumstances, or at least a delayed entry into 155 for Ilya Topuria.
Yeah, it's happened multiple times over in some other weight classes. I mean, look what light heavyweight had to go through in the wake of Jones, either vacating or moving up and things like that. Volkanovski, you know, he tried his hand at lightweight, and I think that kind of maybe arguably set up his downfall as champion. So we'll see what they do. But let's just say, last thing on this, like hypothetical, say Topuria goes to the UFC, says, I'm done. They announce the title is vacant. Who are you putting in a vacant featherweight title fight? You tell Max Holloway, hey, buddy, stop cutting stop bulking up to 55.
No, I tell you what, like Max tweeted me after UFC 300, and he was like, because that, you know, right after UFC 300, it's like he's got so many good options, you know. He tweeted me and he was like, what do you think? And I think he was just being friendly. I don't think he really cared, but I did respond and I was like, you know, I don't know how much sense it makes to go from 155. Back down to 45. And remember, he came up to 55 different this time. This was not the second Poirier fight. And so now that he's back at 55 again, I'm like, dude, just stay there. Like, just, you got good options. You're the BMF champ. Just stay right there. My gut reaction would be, if he really does something like this, it would be Volk and Diego Lopez is kind of the way I would put it. Yeah. You could go a couple of other different directions. Certainly Movsar, after this past weekend, has got a bit of a different conversation to happen. Mm-hmm. But, you know, just thinking on my feet, I think that's a hell of a fight to make, whether for a title or not.
Yeah, I think that's probably the one too, just promotionally speaking, probably the most sellable fight. But yeah, got to feel bad for Movsar because he's obviously got the win over Diego Lopez, but he's ranked above him and seemingly has more fan sentiment on his side. So that would be a tough call for him. But yeah, I guess, you know, speaking on this topic, you mentioned UFC 310 and Alexandre Pantoja. I mean, he has cleared out this division, no doubt. And you said, you know, the thing about moving up to 35, totally agree with your entire thought process there. But he says he doesn't want to do it. I talked to him before the fight. He basically said the only reason he ever spoke of that was because he had beef with Sean O'Malley, stemming from that training session they had a few years ago where some footage came out. So if he stays at 25, which seems like the plan, what do you do with him to come up with something interesting if you're the UFC at this point when he has so many wins over, I guess it'll be top 10-0 against the top 10 now? I don't know where Kai Asakura came in the new rankings.
I think he came in 14.
Oh, wow.
I think he came in 14, yeah. I think it's Kai Kara France. I don't know who else it could even possibly be. Mm-hmm. And then after that, you're going to have some real difficult choices to make. You've got three wins over Brandon Moreno. Are you going to go for a fourth? You could. I don't know how great it would be. And folks would be like, is there really a precedent for that? Well, sort of. I mean, it's different, but when Pacquiao and Marquez fought, Marquez didn't get a clear win. There was obviously losses and draws, but he didn't get a clear win until the fourth one. Mm-hmm. And he viciously KO'd Pacquiao in that fight, if you might recall. So there's you could go that direction. You could have him take a catchweight fight just to stay busy. You could have him do what Ilya is suggesting at 35, which is just take a fight against a top contender. It doesn't have to be for the title, but I don't know if he would get pay-per-view points for that. But it looks like it's probably going to be something like a fourth Moreno fight, or how many times has he beaten Royville? Twice?
Twice.
So it'll be a third Royville fight, and you're just going to have to stick it somewhere on a card where that's got a much bigger supporting cast, or rather, I would say he would be part of the supporting cast, and then you would have some, you know, a Poatan fight or, you know, something else pretty regal at the top of it. I generally just don't, I don't even know what you do except start picking off guys outside the top 10, and I don't know how much sense that makes, but you're left with nothing here. If you don't want to go to 35 and you've got all these wins, who is it? You have to play the hits again.
Yeah, it's a strange situation. I mean, it's getting to the point now of like his reign where, remember with Demetrius Johnson, they had to create a season of the Ultimate Fighter just to find him an opponent. Like, you bring in someone over from Ryzen, they're kind of pulling out those stops now. So if you've already gone to that bag of finding someone outside the promotion, I don't really know what you do to come up with something interesting. I was looking over, like, is there any bantamweights in the top 15 that you could maybe see dropping down to flyweight? And there isn't really anyone who like stands out that at least I look at it being like, oh yeah, this person could trim 10 off their frame. Like, I guess Davidson Figueiredo, since he's still there, but I don't know if he's wanting to do that again because those cuts were painful for him, man.
Oh yeah, the Figueiredo one's an interesting one if they could find a way to do it. But you know, Jesus, I mean, he's 37 or something. Like, that's a tough cut to get down, even when you're much less than that. I mean, the interesting question is, like, should they have let go of Muhammad Mukhaev? And my general view is they probably should not have. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, because folks will say, well, if he was still around, then you'd have another title contender, which is true. But it all seemed to me like Mukhaev's game was in just need of a lot more development. I mean, there was parts of it that were pretty good, the control, the takedowns, that sort of thing. But the rest of it really needed a lot of work. And it's like, dude, you feed a guy like that to Pantoja. Pantoja might, he would just be getting his ass kicked. In all likelihood, he'd be getting his ass kicked. And for what? Like, because you had no one else literally in this division. I mean, part of the real reason that we're having this conversation is, I think the UFC has, this is no secret, they have been non-committal about flyweight for quite some time, and they gutted it and they brought it back, and then they still let guys like this go. And then they get to these problems where it's like somebody finally emerged who was, at least for this moment in time, better than his contemporaries. It was a lot of hot potato before. Well, it's not really hot potato right now, but as a consequence, he's just feasting on these guys, and they have no additional resources. It seems to me that like some better strategic long-term planning about how to manage the flyweight division is probably in order at this point.
Yeah, and I don't think, even if you could get Demetrius Johnson to come back, which seems very unlikely, he's pretty much shut that down. That just seems like a short-term fix, not a long-term solution, because even if he won, I don't think he's sticking around to do that rematch or defend the title or anything. So you're doing kind of what we talked about on the top and, kind of screwing over a division for a short-term move instead of long-term gain.
I would love to see the fight. I mean, I think I'm with you. I mean, who would be against the fight in that sense? I would love to see it, but... my understanding is, I think he has one fight left on his one championship deal. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole rigmarole about even extracting him from that to begin with. They have to find, this is why the partnership with Ryzen makes some sense, obviously, is the talent sharing that would come with it. I think it's a smart move by UFC. I'm glad they're doing it, but it seems like a little bit of more of that is going to be the solution to their problems, because as soon as somebody emerges who is a dominant figure, the dominoes fall very, very quickly. And after a year, you're like, what do we do now?
Yeah. Speaking of messy divisions, heavyweight, another 310 talking point, Ciryl Gane beating Alexander Volkov. I had said coming in that Volkov winning this fight would have been the most chaotic outcome for the division, just because you lose the potential Aspinall versus Gane fight if Jones retires or something like that, and all that stuff. But this seemed like it was not the ideal outcome either, with Gane winning in such a controversial fashion, hurting himself as well. How do you think things shake out from here? Is it all just hinging on whether John Jones wants to fight Tom Aspinall or not, and then you pick up the pieces from there?
Yeah, I mean, the first order of business is you have to see what's coming or going with that, right? I mean, that's the first thing that will dictate everything that falls afterwards. I don't know if you could even run a third fight. Would the UFC even want to? I know Dana White certainly had expressed that he thought Volkov had won. I think most of us probably feel like Volkov won.
Yeah.
But I don't, the UFC is usually correct me if you have a different opinion, but I feel like they don't really run close, but somewhat bad decisions back. They run egregious stoppages back, or, the fight fell out the day of and they have to just move it to a later date. But if you actually have the fight and the decision is bad, they tend to not go back. So if that's not in order, and now you've got Gane up there, I honestly don't know. I haven't even looked at the rankings. Let me pull them up for just a second here, because I think that would obviously dictate what their options might be. I apologize for doing this in real time, but we gotta do this on the fly here. Okay, so at heavyweight, you've got Gane sitting at 2, you've got Volkov sitting at 3. You've got Pavlovich sitting at 4. He just beat him.
Yep.
You've got Blades sitting out there. You got Blades and Almeida. I think Almeida's got the upcoming fight, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, right? Spivak at UFC 311.
Who's just below him. So somewhere between Blades and the winner of Spivak and Almeida, you could disperse those guys depending on who you want to either Gane or Volkov, or however that's going to go. Again, assuming Aspinall gets held for Jones. If he doesn't, then he just becomes the mandatory, or he becomes the full champion. And then I think at that point, if you want to do Aspinall Gane just because it's new, you could do that, but I don't know how well that's going to go for Gane.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. I guess the only upside here is Gane did suffer that injury, and maybe now there's less pressure of like trying to book a fight if it is him and Aspinall, which I think would be the way you go if Jones doesn't fight. So I feel like there's a little bit of pressure off. But Dana did tell us, Dana White told us in New York at that post-fight press conference, like, there is going to be a timeline for Jones to make this decision. He did not put one forward of what that would be, but I'm curious what they're thinking internally that that looks like.
I'd be curious to know what that is as well. I mean, you know, you're let's put on our thinking cap, is your best guess, and that's what we're doing here, International Fight Week for that?
I think so. That it just makes too much sense there, and there's no like kind of seminal event, and I've kind of heard stuff behind the scenes of like where dates and events could be all the way up until May at this point, so that feels like the next big hole in the schedule where you would slot a fight like that.
I mean, they could also slot it back for they obviously they're going to New York City on November or every November or whatever. They could do that, but that's a long wait. I don't know if they want to wait that long, you know.
I don't know if Tom wants to wait that long more so.
Exactly. I don't think he wants to wait that long at all. So it seems like International Fight Week. So if that's the case, then you're thinking probably at least 2 to 3 months before that would need an announcement. So, you know, April-ish, May-ish, something like that is what you're supposed to kind of hear. Heavyweight is not in the same state that flyweight is in. I think it's a little bit healthier in terms of, you know, contenders and whatnot. But if Jones gets removed and Aspinall, it's like you can make the Gon fight. That's new. He already beat Volkov. He already beat Pavlovich. He already beat Blades. Almeida, we have to see if he can get past Spivak. And then on down the list, he's beaten a bunch of these other guys too. It's like, I mean, the reign of Tom Aspinall seems inevitable. It's just a question of when it's going to get started.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we might be getting to the point if he needs challengers, some guys need to move up from light heavyweight, but we'll see what happens.
No question about it. No question about it.
Yeah. I guess last UFC 310 talking point, the co-main event, I think Ian Garry and Shavkat Rakhmonov kind of both impressed us all. At least that was my takeaway from it. Ian Garry seems to feel very strongly that they will fight again at some point. Do you think we get a rematch at some point in the future, and would it be for a title?
I think we do, and I think the answer is probably yes. Yeah. So Daniel Cormier got on his YouTube channel and said he had heard that Shavkat had torn an MCL. I texted his manager, not DC's manager, but Shavkat's manager, to see if that was true, and they said that like they're not sure. Basically, he was like, you know, probably could be true, but we are going to get the MRI, and then we'll know. Then we'll know what the full extent of the damage is, and then we'll make a call from there. That puts him out roughly, by the way, potentially up to 6 months, probably a little bit less, but maybe closer to 3 to 4, but something to keep in mind.
Yeah.
If, in fact, he was injured and that has some explanation about why that fight was a little bit closer than we had anticipated, then, you know, I think that some of the harsh criticism or some of the criticism that Rakhmonov received is probably a little bit overdone, including by people like me and some other folks. However, I will sort of say consistently, I do think there's a problem with Garry in the sense that his offense, it's causing him a couple of problems in the sense that if you look at this fight and you look at the Jeff Neal fight, he really does a good job of just kind of stifling the action on the opponent's terms and then creating these moments for himself. And it's actually a very effective strategy for the most part, but it keeps these rounds kind of close, right? It reminds me of Sean Strickland. Sean Strickland has a different style, but it's this trench warfare that he engages in, and it defines the whole fight. But it also just necessarily means you're lobbing, I'm lobbing, you're lobbing, I'm lobbing, and it kind of stays close that way. And so I think that really is holding Garry back. On the other hand, he's 27 years old. He has a lot of time to work on that. And also, his defense is very good. His sense of timing, his fast feet, his footwork more generally, his distance management, his takedown defense, like all of that is actually pretty good. But it's just when you go back to the offense, there's not quite enough of it. It's not quite damaging enough. And even in some of those finishing sequences, he's got his head on the wrong side of the choking arm and everything. Like, there's a little bit of polish left. But I definitely feel like you have to watch this fight and be like, you know what, man? Ian Garry has earned my respect. Maybe I'm sure with many of the people who earned it before. But if you were holding out, this was one of those times to cross the Rubicon, so to speak. And at the same time, 27, man, by the time he's 30, he might be doing something really special in the sport.
Yeah, I tend to agree. And you listen to kind of his post-fight media. He says he already knows the things he can fix and he's going to take some time off, maybe till International Fight Week as well. He said and kind of clean those things up. So maybe he's seeing the same things you're seeing there. But you hope the aggression turns up the more he trains with these shootbox guys down there too, right? Because I think that's kind of their patented style. He said Charles Oliveira taught him that choke. Apparently not well enough, but he did a good job. So I guess that kind of puts a bow on 310. And Luke, when we get into ranking our pay-per-views here, before you give me your specific number for UFC 310, I just kind of want to get a feel on maybe how you're going to rank this. Where did UFC 310 fit in your list? Was it 1 to 5, 6 to 10, or in the 11 to 14 range?
Yeah, it's 11 to 14. I have it specifically at 12.
Okay.
Now, if I may, I looked at these pay-per-views and I mean, clearly some are stronger than others. That's the mm-hmm. whole point of the ranking. But even for the ones at the bottom, there were some nicer elements about it, or there was things that were of value. It's a UFC pay-per-view. Like, even when they're not their best, they're usually got something on them of significant value. But I want to just mention my methodology here a little bit, if I may. Yeah, which is you tasked me with ranking these with main card only, right?
Yes.
So I'm putting premium on how did they actually turn out in the end? Because some were like, look, we're stacked on paper and then, or, you know, whatever. How did they actually turn out in the end? How many relevant fights did they have? How many relevant and then excellent fights did they have? How many pound-for-pound guys were on the card or certainly headlining at the top of them? And then kind of mixing from there, like, give me a solid main event, give me solid action, give me meaningful action. And I kind of put that in the wash and then came up with this list.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. I did a similar thing. I mean, I want to have you on for this as well, because I think you cover most of these from home, right? And you're doing like mm-hmm. either live streams or something around watching them. And a lot of these, I think 8 pay-per-views this year I was at. And sometimes you're in the back in the media room doing interviews while fights are going on. You miss certain things. And sometimes you're cage side and not hearing commentary or seeing broadcast elements. So there's a lot of, I guess, different viewpoints on how this goes down. So my methodology a little bit, the way I started, I didn't look at any of the cards. And since I was at a lot of these, I was just kind of sitting there being like, how many things can I actually recall off the top of my head, like without looking it up, whether it's a moment, a fight itself? And I'll be honest, man, a lot of these, I could not think more than one fight off the top of my head. Like, I was like, what was the co-main event on there? There are some weak cards this year. It's just the truth. I mean, whether that was intentional from like putting fights on the prelims, which I think was an interesting thing first. And I'll ask you this before you get into it, because this was a big thing with 310, right? Like Aljamain Sterling and stuff being on the prelims there. How much of people do you think that are like watching and ordering the pay-per-views that would tune in on ESPN for, say, the Aljo Movsar fight or those ones are watching the pay-per-view anyways? Like, do you think when they look through and be like, it's not a big deal because we're retaining 90% of our audience who's watching Aljamain Sterling on the prelims anyways, as opposed to if we put him in the second fight on the main card?
I think there is something to that, but I also feel like, you know, they're not equivalent. You know what I mean? Like, oh, 90% of the audience kind of carries over, right? Except that the real casual fan interest, in terms of especially what the media will focus on with their coverage after the fact, will be much more affected by main card placement. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, you're just going to get more news coverage around that. You're going to get your chance of going viral for any reason, or just for a story carrying. It doesn't have to be on the main card, but it certainly goes up when it's on the main card. There's just a level of sort of cascading effect that can happen with main card placement versus on the prelim. So it's not like you're in purgatory and that no one saw it. That's really not the point. But, you know, even if there is a substantial audience carryover, there is still a treatment that happens from main card placement, generally speaking, that gets lost when you're on the prelims.
Yeah, I agree. And like, especially if you look at the fallout too, I mean, some of these stat cards, you know, the fighters who are at the end make it to the post-fight press conference, UFC streams that, it's available to the world, you get your exposure there. If you're on the prelims, you know, they'll bring you back and every media outlet might not publish your scrum. Like, I know MMA Fighting and the MacLife, like, don't they'll publish a handful over at MMA Junkie. We still throw them all up. It's kind of been true to like the Junkie name and stuff, but you look at the whole lay of the land, your interview may go up or it may not on most of these media outlets. So that's, I guess, something too that kind of goes into that same vein. But okay, to carry on from that, Luke, so we kind of talked a little bit about the methodology, all that stuff. We are going to go from best to worst here. So you can start out. What was your number one UFC pay-per-view of 2024?
Well, I don't know if we'll have necessarily a big difference on this one, although I suppose we could. But even if we're not in lockstep, I doubt we're very far apart. I'm going to go UFC 300 for the first one. I just feel like between Poatan beating Jamal and then him doing the, you know what I mean, which got turned into a super meme. Zhang Weili versus Yan Xiaonan didn't make a huge splash, but it was a fine fight. Max Holloway having the KO of the year, and not just KO of the year, frankly, MMA moment of the year, and arguably combat sports moment of the year, because I watch a lot of boxing, and I don't remember a single moment that had boxing fans all year doing what UFC fans were doing from this KO to Max Holloway. Like, which one just resonated across the world? Certainly Max Holloway. Armin Saryukin in a tough fight against Charles Oliveira. It's relevant, two big names. You get a title shot from it. And then the Bo Nickel fight was just kind of there. It didn't necessarily add a whole lot. But I mean, I just don't know what would be a better card than this one. UFC 300, number one for me.
Yeah, this is the layup. Totally agree. I mean, I was there. I got the luck of having one of the few octagon side seats they still provide to media at T-Mobile Arena in Las Vegas. I think it's being cut from like 16 or like 26 to 12 or something to make more rooms for seats. But felt privileged to be in there. And yeah, man, I'll never forget that Max Holloway, Justin Gaethje, final 10 seconds. Like, you know, you're not supposed to film the action. I know they say that, but I was like, hey, like, he pointed to the ground, pulled my camera out, and when he dropped him with that punch, it was just insane. John Morgan, my longtime colleague, formerly at MMA Junkie, was sitting right in front of me, and he just had his hands on his head and was just jaw completely down. And I think that was everyone in the entire arena. And yeah, I thought that was one of the most alpha things you could ever see in your life. And then two fights later, you saw Alex Pereira do that amazing knockout, wave off the low blow, and point to the ground. So, yeah, I mean, UFC 300, I think, in terms of expectations, execution, all that stuff, I think this was the pinnacle of 2024, and I don't think you could have asked for something to come together much better than that.
Yeah, and by the way, if I'm ranking the centennial pay-per-views, mm-hmm. I'm still going to go UFC 100, number one. I'll go 300 as two, and I'll go 200 as three.
Yeah, I like that too. That's a good extra note there. Yeah, man. Did you watch all three of those live? Do you remember where you were for each of those?
200, I was there. Mm-hmm. I was in Las Vegas for that one.
I remember.
And then 100, I was here. And then 300, I was here at home. Yeah.
Yeah. UFC 100, I was in, I think, just graduated from grade 12 from high school. And we had a kegger in my basement with some of my friends. And I don't think any of us were of age then. But I fondly remember that. And the next morning, making one of my friends do a keg stand out of the warm keg.
Which, awesome. Yeah. Awesome. Done a few of those in my time.
Yeah. Okay. I will go with my number two second here. I put UFC 308 to Poirier versus Holloway. That was a great card too, of course, in the main event. Ilya Topuria becoming the first to knock out Max Holloway. Co-main event, Khamzat Chimaev breaking Robert Whittaker's face with that face crank. Megamed Ankalaev versus Rakic was all right. Lauren Murphy versus Dan Ige was all right. And then Shara Bullitt landing that first double spinning back fist knockout. That was a very good card. It was crazy. Surreal Gone versus Volkov was supposed to be on that one, the aforementioned fight originally as well. That fell apart. And yeah, that was a nice one. I'm sure you enjoyed watching an afternoon pay-per-view as well. I was freaking exhausted because I did back-to-back weeks from the PFL event in Saudi Arabia straight to Abu Dhabi. So by the time we got to that final night watching that fight, I was pretty cooked, but it was still a very enjoyable watch.
Yeah, so my number two is also UFC 308. I just don't know how you could pick anything else. Topuria Holloway, to me, was the best fight that they could make in MMA at that time. They made it. It delivered. It was competitive. You know, it was competitive, definitely, for as long as it lasted. And then Topuria basically just took over because he's obviously a pretty special guy. Khamzat literally rearranging the face of Robert Whittaker, especially after all those questions when the fight fell out and you didn't know if he was going to make it and blah, blah, blah. And he had that weird kind of low energy attitude during fight week, and then he just showed up and ran the guy over. Magomed Ankalaev versus Rakic was fine. There was nothing super special about it, but it was okay. Lerone Murphy versus Dan Ige, maybe the most underrated good fight this year. I mean, just a fantastic contest. And then Shara Bullitt with the bop, bop, you know, the double spinning back fist. You know, this was such a great card, top to bottom. Afternoon, as you indicated, for here for the folks of the stateside. Super, 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 super high quality. And by the way, 300 was probably the best event, but it wouldn't be my favorite event. This would be my favorite event. This one, to me, felt a little bit more dynamic as a card.
Yeah, and you can't get any bigger than what happened in the main event. I mean, Ilya Topuria versus Max Holloway was a lot of people's most anticipated fight of the year. It delivered, maybe if you're not a Max Holloway fan, but in terms of like a decisive, important finish for the sport, all that stuff, it was fantastic. Okay, number three, Luke, I want to hear yours first on this because I may have deviated a little off track here. So I'm curious to see what you put at three compared to mine.
So this one, it was tough. This is where I had to I wasn't sure about which direction to go, but I ultimately decided I'm going to go UFC 299, Sean O'Malley taking on Chito Vera. Now that was kind of a one-way ass kicking, but it was fun for what it was. But you had Poirier with one last heroic performance against Benoit Saint-Denis in the co-main. Michael Page versus Kevin Holland was fine. Jack Della versus Gilbert Burns was awesome. What a phenomenal fight that was. And then Yan versus Song Yadong. This was Yan getting back into the win column in a really important way against a tough guy, opening the main card with it. I can see a different card going in this place. This one I did feel a little bit uneasy with the placement. Certainly one of the better cards UFC did this year. I don't think there's really any question about that. Where it ranks exactly, I don't know, but I kind of gave it three. I really liked this card. I liked some of the heroics from it. And again, you had important fights, certainly with Sean O'Malley at that time, and it did deliver good action for as long as you watched it. I liked it.
Yeah, so this one was in my top five. I'll reveal the placement later, but yeah, agreed. Maybe I lost some points on this one because I was absolutely miserable during it. If you recall, this fight took place the day after Francis Ngannou versus Anthony Joshua, which was on a Friday. And I was out there in Saudi Arabia for it. And the event went so goddamn long, Luke, that I had to change my flight that was originally at 10 a.m. And it would have got me home in time to watch UFC 299. We didn't get out of the arena till 7 a.m. when Ngannou and Joshua finished their press conference. There's no way I was going to be able to upload all my stuff and make it in time. So I had to call, change my whole flight an extra day. And then I had to watch UFC 299 in my Saudi Arabia hotel room when I was very tired. And they do not have alcohol available for purchase in Saudi Arabia, Luke. Mm-hmm. So I had to watch this sober, exhausted, and just wanting to be anywhere but there and back home. But it was great to see Dustin Poirier obviously get that spectacular win. It was a good card, but yeah, I think watching it at 7 a.m. or whatever it was for me in a weird time zone just took a little something away from it.
Yeah, well, those road miles will completely jaundice your perspective, but I enjoyed it. It was a great card for me, for sure.
Yes. Okay, so number three, this is, you might be surprised for my side. I went with UFC 306 at the Sphere, and it basically had nothing to do with the quality of the fights. I was going more off the production, the video packages, the elements, the entire atmosphere of that. Of course, the prelims were a little slow in terms of like presentation, but UFC, I think, put its best foot forward production-wise during that event. It felt different from anything you're used to watching. Everything is kind of carbon copy when it comes to these broadcasts. That one was different. I enjoyed it. And just the uniqueness of that event and the broadcast experience vaulted it that high up the list. I debated it for a small second putting it at number one, but I thought that was maybe a bridge too far.
That is a bridge too far. Now, when I made my list, I actually purposely did not include that.
Okay.
Which you could do.
Totally fair. I said open criteria.
That's right. You told me open criteria. So I decided, okay, I loved the Sphere show. I absolutely loved the Sphere show. And I had not gone to the Sphere show, but you may have seen or not heard, I had gone to, I lost a bet to my Morning Combat co-host, Brian Campbell. And so I had to go attend one of his stupid ass concerts at that place. Yeah. And I was blown away. I could not believe how good it was. And for that reason, I really enjoyed I thought the UFC did a phenomenal job with the Sphere. But I wanted to judge it for this particular list, mm-hmm. like, you know, quality of the fights, how much did they deliver? And I do have 306 at a decent position, but that co-main event really just left a bad taste in my mouth. And I didn't hate the main event, but I didn't love it. So I had to give it a little bit of a lower ranking than you.
No, it's totally fair. I mean, you have a main card there that has five decisions on it, two title fight decisions. Like, it's hard. I mean, I totally cheated here in terms of like quality. But as I said, the open criteria, I kind of wanted a melting pot of all the things we talked about off the top. So I slid that one in there as a little cheat, but I did not cheat on this one. My number four, I put UFC 305. Which took place in the furthest place on earth I can possibly travel to from Toronto, Perth, Australia. It was a struggle to get there, but I thought that card delivered. I mean, Dricus du Plessis versus Israel Adesanya, that was an anticipated fight for a long time. I thought it delivered. Kaikar France knocks out Steve Ersig in the co-main event. Dan Hooker and Mateus Gamrot put on a thriller on the main card. Rosenstrike and Tai Tuivasa was kind of average, and then Carlos Prochus kind of had his coming out party to open that main card with the KO of the Leech, the first one to ever do that. So yeah, that was a fun one, another weird experience. You know, you're watching fights at 9 a.m. in the morning in Australia, completely different time zone. It's a completely different vibe, but that card was good, man. I enjoyed that one a lot, and Dricus versus Izzy was just something that had a big storyline, and I thought we finally got to see it play out, and it was good.
So I have that one at 6. I don't have it at 4, but I definitely have it towards the top of my list. I really like that card. As you mentioned, there was bad blood, or at least, you know, it was presented as bad blood when they made it. And I think it delivered for as long as it lasted. The Kaikar France Steve Ersig one and the co-main was also fantastic. Dan Hooker, as you indicated, Mateusz Gamrot, that was such a surprising result. I don't know how many people really thought it was going to go that particular direction. No. And then Carlos Prochus, he had a phenomenal 2024, of which this win over the Leech played a big role. There is a lot to like on this card. And again, I ranked it pretty highly, not quite as high, but pretty high.
What did you have as your four?
For my four, I went UFC 298. This was Volkanovski versus Topuria. This was the beginning of the Volk thing. And part of the reason why I like this one is you'll recall, like, during fight week, how many people, I mean, Volk did the old man thing, and people were just like,
grab the belt.
Yeah. And people were just completely dismissing Topuria. And I'm like, I think that's a big mistake. Mm-hmm. And the fight ended up not being very long, but for as long as it was very good. Also, folks don't remember that Volk took the first round on all three judges' scorecards in that fight, which is a fun little detail. But then you have Robert Whittaker versus Paulo Costa. That fight was not like a barn burner, but it was certainly high quality. Gary and Neil, again, not a barn burner, but high quality. Marab and Henry, that one, I know some folks think that one grinded, but that was like a really important big fight that I was not. And he got, you know, hurt and rocked in the first. And then Fluffy Hernandez versus Roman Kopylov was a fucking awesome fight. And so between having, you know, pound for pound level guys in your main event and, you know, important number one contender bouts, and then like at middleweight, like this super high quality Fluffy Hernandez Kopylov fight, I love this card. I like this one a lot. So I give it for my number four.
Definitely a good one. I had that at number 7. What was your number 5 to round out your top 5 here?
So for my 5, I'm going to go with one that I don't think is super controversial. I suppose I could be wrong about this. I'm going to go with UFC. Let me put my list here. Yeah, I'm going to go with UFC 302. This was Makhachev versus Poirier. Now, this one I do think is also probably a little bit debatable, if I do say so myself. This was in New Jersey, and it kind of came together a little bit late, but I'll tell you why. First of all, Makhachev, pound for pound, best guy in the sport. I'm going to just give weight to whenever those guys like that compete. It's just much more important when people like that compete, generally speaking. Poirier, by the way, a worthy adversary in this fight, which I also thought was kind of interesting. Like, that fight was, of all the ways that fight could have gone, it actually went one of the more interesting ways. The main event sucked in Sean Strickland versus Paulo Costa. I didn't get a ton of value out of that. Kevin Holland ran through Oleshchyk, which was fine. Nico Price versus Alex Moreno was okay. You know what? Maybe I overranked it a little bit, actually. Now that I'm going through it here, a little more detail. I might have ranked that one a little too highly, because here's the thing. I am going to give weight to Islam, and there's a couple of other things on here I liked. But you know what? In real time, I would actually put this a little bit lower. I'm sorry that I put it here. I would switch. You know what I would do? I would switch 302, and I would actually put 305 and 306 ahead of it. So I have to leave it where I put it. But I actually now, in saying it out loud, I now regret it. Sorry. Yeah,
that's fair. I mean, I had it. So what, it would have landed at 8 then with your reshuffle?
It would have landed at 5, 6. It would have landed at 7.
Okay. So I have it at 8. So I don't think that's, you know, too off there. So yeah, I think that's a fine one to have there. I mean, for my number 5, we talked about already, UFC 299, O'Malley versus Vera. So I think we're dealing with a lot of the same players for the most part in our top 5, 6 range here. So I think it was pretty close there. Since I don't want to take too much more of your time here, I feel like we can jump down the list a little bit. Want to just tell me before we kind of get into the bottom half here, give me your 7 to 12.
Okay, so assuming that we had moved 302 down, it would have been, I'll just go through it very quickly, 300, yep. 308, 299, 298, and then I would go 305, 306, 302. Right, so that gets me down a little bit. Then I'm going to go 309 Jones Miocic.
Okay.
Sorry, which one were you asking for specifically?
So you had Jones Miocic at number 8. Is that correct?
Yeah, but you want me to go all the way down the list?
Yeah. Save your last two though. Don't read me 13 and 14.
Okay. So then I had 309 Jones Miocic. I had 303 Poatan Jiří 2. Mm-hmm. Then I had 304. This one, I feel like the answer could be 304 could have moved to a few different places, but I've got 304 there, Muhammad versus Edwards. Then I've got 307, Poatan Roundtree, because that one had a great main event, but not a super strong supporting cast at all. Mm-hmm. So that's the thing. It's like he's a pound for pound guy too, but he was like, and that the main event was excellent, but he had not a lot of help.
Yeah.
Right. And then I won't say the last two, but then I guess what would it be? 12.
Yeah.
I'll have 310 Pantoja Asakura, the one we just had.
Okay. Ours aren't vastly different there. So I'll leave 13 and 14 just because I'm writing yours out so we can compare here. So yeah, in that same range, for number 6, I had 301 Pantoja versus Usyk. Number 7, I had 298 Topuria versus Volkanovski. Number 8, I had 302. Makhachev versus Poirier. Number 9, I had 310 Pantoja versus Asakura. Number 10, I had 304. Number 11, I had 303. Number 12, I had 307. So I guess I'll start off with my 13 there. You had it higher. For 13, I had Jones versus Miocic, UFC 309.
Wow.
Yeah, and I just put it kind of low. I mean, I was there a couple of weeks ago. It was a very special week for me. I got engaged. It was a
great congrats. Week.
So, like, it was an awesome week. But, yeah, given that main card, if you go back, like, how lopsided the betting odds were on pretty much every fight, so, like, they were all pretty wide. For us to get 4 decisions out of that, I think, you know, the Bo Nickel fight against Paul Craig really took some luster off of that event, yes. How that went down. I thought Karina Silva kind of folded a little bit after that first round, and that made that fight. It was okay, but nothing special. And Rufy versus Lontop was solid as well, but I don't know, didn't knock my socks off. And then as entertaining and wild as that final minute was with Michael Chandler and Charles Oliveira, that fight was largely uncompetitive, as was Jones versus Miocic. So that kind of put it pretty far down for me, and no one can accuse me of recency bias putting it too high, right? Because it's way down there. So who did you have as your number 13?
For my number 13, I had 297 Strickland versus Duplessis.
Okay.
Now if you actually look at the card itself, it was not like, if you watched it, you got like a bunch of boring decisions. That's really not the case, but let's go through them here in just a minute. Movsar Evloev versus Arnold Allen. Now, that's a quality fight. There's just
it was the worst fight in UFC history, according to Dana White at the post.
Well, okay. But it was 2 quality fighters.
I know.
And a meaningfully important fight. Like, I respect it on that level. But yeah, it wasn't a barn burner. Chris Curtis, Marc-Andre Barrio. Here's the thing. This fight was in Canada, right? So this one took place at the Scotiabank Arena.
Toronto, yep, right here.
From your neck of the woods. So they're just putting a bunch of Canadian dogs on there, which of course they're going to do. But they tend to make, you know, the cards aren't quite... I mean, this is not 2000... You know, it's not 2009 anymore when GSP was leading this Canadian revolution. It's a different place now when they go to Canada. They're obviously very, very good Canadian fighters. But it's not the same. They're not like as just dynamically full in all these weight classes as they once were. So like... Chris Curtis versus Marc-Andre Barrio just seems, you know, it's not. I like Chris Curtis a lot. I actually really like his boxing style, but I don't know if that belongs on a pay-per-view. And then you have Neil Magny versus Mike Malott, which was a huge upset. But that to me was more like disappointing in favor of Malott, who should have won that one walking away and then didn't. And then that co-main was just dreadful. That co-main is maybe the worst co-main all year. Yeah. I mean, that was horrible. And that's not Raquel Pennington's fault. It was really on the Silva side. But Jesus, that was terrible. And the thing about the Duplessis Strickland fight, it was not a, people were like, oh, it was a, you know, a slow cooking thriller. I don't know about that, but I didn't mind it. I actually did not mind it. I thought it was a close, tough battle between two very good fighters. In the end, in real time, I thought that Duplessis won. Upon review, I actually was like, maybe Strickland has a case. And of course, it leads us to UFC 312 down the line, but not overall one of those events that was over and that you'll remember as like an important contribution to developing your fandom. You know what I mean?
For sure. I had UFC 297 as 14th as my worst pay-per-view. It hurts me. It happened here in Toronto. Like, I don't want to say that. It was literally right down the street from me. But yeah, man, it was the first card of the year. It was freezing cold up here. But yeah, it just didn't play out very well. That you listed it all kind of fight by fight there. I thought the main event was certainly not, I guess, what some people maybe reflect it to be in hindsight, maybe because both guys were so beat up and Dricus's eye was messed up. People felt like it was a greater war than it was. Like, it was fine. We've seen worse title fights. But yeah, to close it off after that Pennington versus Mayra Bueno Silva fight, it was just felt like a very, very long night. I mean, again, the only finish you get on the main card is with 15 seconds left in round three, courtesy of Neil Magny there. So yeah, a lot of decisions, a lot of slow moves. It just didn't do it for me. As much as I wanted to put this one higher, I was like, I was there for a lot of them, and this one was just not great to me. So what did you have? I think I can't do the process of elimination here. So tell me, what was your 14?
So again, this is one you probably could have moved around. I don't know that it really deserves this placement, but again, I'm just kind of trying to figure out where things go. I put UFC 301 down there, and I know that the response might be, well, there were definitely some good and important fights on there, which is true. So for example, you had Patoja versus Ursek. Here's why this one bothered me so much. I mean, they pulled Ursek off of the Matt Schnell win, right, to get this. And the dude could have won this, but made like a consistent series of bad decisions in the course of this fight, and particularly how the fight ended, like going for the takedown at the end. And I was just like, oh my fucking God. Sorry for cursing, but it's like, oh my God, dude, what are you doing? Like, what are you doing? And so that really left a bit of a bad taste in my mouth. Jose Aldo versus Jonathan Martinez was great. I don't have any problems with it. Martinez was up for a big fight, and Jose Aldo let him know that, you know, there's levels to this kind of thing. Smith beating Vitor Petrino, it's like, I appreciate that Smith is always going to have good submissions. And you and I like Anthony Smith a lot. We've probably talked to him off camera a million times. Mm-hmm. He's a great guy. I've always had a great relationship with him. You saw how things went for him more recently. Now, again, he's dealing with tragedy. It's a different story. But, like, you know, Smith on, this is not like the, like in 2024, you did not get peak Smith. And he's just rolling over some of these guys. And it was kind of like, why was this fight on the main card? Why was Smith even fighting this guy? You know, Smith's just, even in a diminished state, much better than him.
He says himself, he's like, I'll never tell my kids about the time I beat Vitor Petrino when we're sitting around the campfire. He said this in multiple interviews now. I'm like, Jesus, you have worse wins than that, bro, that you could like,
But like, it just didn't mean anything. It was just a thing that happened. Then Michelle Pineda beating Ihor Potiaria. I don't even know why Ihor Potiaria is in the UFC. I just don't get it. That one did nothing for me. Now, the Caio Bahalio one beating Paul Craig one stands out to a degree, but it's like Paul Craig, you know, God bless him. I love him. He's fucking amazing to hang out with, but he doesn't move his head at all. Like, it was just kind of watching target practice for a little bit, to be honest with you. And so for that reason, it didn't move me in that way. But I do recognize there's another way to look at it, which is like, you got three finishes in a row, and you got a really kind of spirited main and co-main. I can respect that.
Yeah, I think that is a good way to look at it. I don't disagree with that. I think that event, UFC 301, just looking at what I jaw down here, that's probably the biggest discrepancy we have on our list. I think if you had it at 14, I had it at 6. So I valued, I guess, maybe just the entertainment factor a little bit higher. I mean, you're looking at a lot of these cards and there's either four decisions on the main card or all decisions. That one just had a little more than that. So I think maybe that's why I valued it slightly higher. But I think your approach there, totally fair and reasonable. So yeah,
what's your 14?
My 14 was UFC 297. The one.
Did I say, that's right. I'm sorry. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. The Canadian flag bearer.
Yeah. And I should have, I was going to throw you this piece of trivia off the top. I should have done this before we started our list. It was just a little bit of fun here. I think you might have name dropped all these people at one point throughout here. But Luke, can you name which one of these four fighters did not fight on a pay-per-view main card in 2024? Okay. Cody Brundage, Ihor Pateria, Alex Morono, or Junior Tafa?
Junior Tafa.
Correct. There you go. That might have been a little tougher before the second.
Yeah, I don't know if I would have gotten it before, but you know, now that I had the cliff notes, I could cheat sheet.
Yeah, he was close to one, I think, and had to pull out. So I think at one point Tafa was scheduled there, and I think we'll probably get a Tafa fight at UFC 312. So I think they just announced that as well. There you go. Well, I think, yeah, this year maybe not the UFC's strongest ever from like a consistency standpoint. This is what happens when you have to pluck for a UFC 300 type card, right? If that was out of there, what would the rest of these pay-per-views throughout the year and especially in those summer months have looked like? I think maybe an argument to be made there, and I don't think we necessarily have something like that coming in 2025, but their schedule to start off the year is pretty nice from my perspective. Which one of these four title fights that are official now is most intriguing to you? Islam Makhachev versus Armin Sarukian, Merab Dvalishvili versus Umar Nurmagomedov, both at UFC 311 on January 18th, or the recently announced Dricus du Plessis versus Sean Strickland rematch, and Zhang Wali versus Tatiana Suarez at 312.
I'm going to say, for me personally, the one that's most interesting is going to be Umar and Merab. I feel like, you know, Merab has... For a guy who I sort of get it, right? Because he had to fight all these tough dudes back to back to back to back, and he didn't have it easy. But now you're a champion, you have to defend against who is available and who is deserving. And of the guys that are in that criteria, Umar is the guy at this point. And like Merab making it like very obvious he doesn't want to fight him. And I don't say that being like, oh, he's afraid of him. I don't mean it that way. I mean, like, you know, if you're Merab, you finally got to the top. This is your chance to make money. And then in your first title defense, you got to fight the Nurmagomedov family. Like, I sort of get why he wants a softer landing to make some cash. I really do. But it's still a very intriguing fight as a fight property because Umar can do many of the things that Merab can do and then many other things that Merab cannot do. But that Suarez one is interesting too, right? She had the Lemos fight. It fell through. She had the Janjiroba fight. It fell through. They just said, you know what? Go to the front, title shot. Like, it's now or never. I kind of like that, actually. I really don't hate that at all. So that could be a fun one as well. But they're all pretty good in their own way, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, no disappointment that it's not Khamzat versus Du Plessis, or do you think? I mean, they promised Sean Strickland the title shot. Like, is I don't know if he got it in writing. He actually may have, which would have been a very savvy move by his team, if so. Yeah. But I know there was issues. Like, the Australia government did not want him there after him punching the fan and all that stuff last time. Like, that is a fact. And they didn't want Khamzat really either because he's got his own slew of issues. I guess they went around the horn and ultimately they kind of forced them to take the Sean Strickland fight. So I don't
hate the fight at all. I think it could be an intriguing fight. I think the second one could be a lot better than the first one. But I was surprised that they did it, to your point you raised. Like, you know, we've been watching MMA long enough to have seen how many guys have sat on title shots, and that simply did not work. And then when you're waiting, the other guy who could get it goes in there and just blows the doors off of a previous champion. You're like, oh, man. You're cooked. But then he got it. I will say this in defense of Sean Strickland in this particular sense, which is he did do the UFC a lot of favors when he was kind of coming up a little bit. And I wonder if they just, you know, kind of made him a verbal promise and then, you know, really stuck to it this time in ways that maybe in other situations they haven't. I was also surprised they took him back to Australia, which also has different speech laws. And we know that's going to be probably a problem for somebody like Sean Strickland, but they did it. Here we go. Let's see what happens.
Yep, most definitely. Well, yeah, it's shaping up to be a good 2025. I'm sure there'll be many, many chances to talk about that both here and on your great show, Morning Combat. Luke, before I get you out here, anything you want to plug, tell the people where they can find you over the next few weeks here.
Yeah, just youtube.com/LukeThomas, youtube.com/Morning Combat with a K. Either one of those places, we appreciate your support.
Awesome, Luke. I appreciate you for being here, man. Like I said off the top, you kind of brought me onto your shows and were someone who was a big mentor to me early on, man. And still remember us meeting for the first time at Beat the Streets in New York oh so many years ago. And obviously that city has become an even more special place to me recently after the engagement. So thank you for being here, Luke. Appreciate you. Hope to have you on many more times in the future. Going to take a quick break here and then I'll be back to wrap things up. And that does it for another episode of The Bonfire. Thank you so much to Luke Thomas for joining the show for the first time. Follow his great work over there on Morning Combat. One of my favorite people in the game. Love Luke and appreciate him being here for me to rank these UFC pay-per-views. Curious to know, did we get it right? Did we get it wrong? Leave me a comment or a message on any platform and let me know if your list stacks up differently to ours or if we had this thing on point. And that does it. We will be back here next week after what is the final UFC event of 2024, UFC Tampa, going down this weekend. MMA Junkie will have Danny Segura there for the Joaquin Buckley versus Colby Covington main event, a pretty compelling fight to close out the 2024 schedule for the year. And we will be back next week as we move forward to some very exciting podcasts to close out the year. I have some special guests lined up, some special topics as we review 2024 and look ahead to 2025 during that break in the schedule that I talked about with Luke Thomas there. So thank you everyone for tuning in. We will see you back here on The Bonfire.